Good morning. If it please the court, I'm Joshua Colangelo with Dorsey & Whitney, which represents Mr. Sampson. If I could just note as a threshold matter, Mr. Solomon's argument that the government did not make a complete proffer of facts, that is entirely inaccurate. At the oral argument before Judge Irizarry, the government made the very same statement, "Your Honor, we haven't proffered all facts." Judge Irizarry then allowed the government to make a supplemental submission of whatever those facts would be, which the government did, which Judge Irizarry properly found was irrelevant. So as to the proffer issue, that simply does not exist at this point. In terms of the fundamental argument that there is a jury question about embezzlements occurring in 2008, the government cannot take that position credibly now, in part based on its prior admissions. First, we have the charging instrument in this case, which says that embezzlements occurred in 1998 and 2002, respectively. Now, in 1998 and 2002, Sampson violated court orders and a statute by not depositing funds with the court. Instead, he kept those funds in banks other than those that the court directed him to use.
Do you think the crime of embezzlement was complete on day six, or just merely at the deposit of the funds in the banks that were other than those designated by the court order?
I think there are two ways to look at it. One is that if you look at Tusi, for example, and Irvine, which I'd be happy to discuss in greater detail, at the end of the period, in Tusi it was a five-day period in which you're supposed to act. If you don't act, you have committed the crime. In Irvine, they talk about it as a duty of an immediate payment and a refusal to comply with that duty. So certainly—
That can't be right under the statute, right? If your client had forgotten to remit the funds so that on day six they're not remitted, we wouldn't say that the crime of embezzlement had been completed.
Well, certainly the defendant in Tusi could have argued, "Your Honor, I forgot to register for the draft. I was busy with my comic books. You can't hold that against me." But that does—
About registering for the draft, not the crime of embezzlement.
Certainly, but I do think that there's an analogy. That brings, however, a different point up, which is the allegation is not that Mr. Sampson on the sixth day said, "Shucks, I forgot to deposit those funds, let me do that now." In fact, the allegation as to Forbell is that between 1998 and 2008, when the government says the charged embezzlements occurred, there was no deposit at all. That's a 10-year period. As to 8th Avenue, the funds were supposed to be deposited with the court in 2002, and in 2008, the government says no deposit had been made. So if we look back again at Irvine, which we submit supports the view that failing to comply with an immediate demand for payment constitutes the crime, it also speaks to a distinction between excusable delay and unreasonable delay. So here, within that time frame, certainly one would have to say that it became clear that the funds were being embezzled.
Help me understand why it's not ultimately a jury question.
Okay, so first of all, we have the charging instrument, which says that embezzlements occurred at the time when the only action was the violation of the court order. It was not a matter of funds being withdrawn at all. And instead, those monies were held in accounts that the court didn't even know about. So contrary to Mr. Solomon's argument, we can't say those funds were legitimately held in escrow. Then during the trial, the government said to the jury, quote, "The defendant's lying and stealing began quite a while ago, the late 1990s, early 2000s, when he embezzled, stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from referee accounts that he controlled," close quote. Again, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, there are no withdrawals at all. It's only the failure to deposit money. Then in two briefs to the district court.
I'm sorry, I thought there were withdrawals from the two accounts in the late 1990s.
No, Your Honor.
Until 2002?
So as to the 8th Avenue account, The first evidence that we have of a withdrawal is in 2004. And as to the Forbell account, the first evidence we have of withdrawal is 2007. Now, I would note, as to Forbell, although the first withdrawal is in 2007, by the time we get to the charged crime, $60,000 or so of the $80,000 had been withdrawn, yeah. Which I think underscores the point that the court was making earlier, that we also have these serial withdrawals during the period in which the court orders are being violated, which further establish intent, and presumably is why the government argued to the jury and to the district court, where it said all embezzlements were completed by 2006, and secured a charging instrument that tied the embezzlements to the failure to deposit funds. I mean, the facts are not disputed here. Sampson was a referee in two matters. The statute directed him to deposit funds within 5 days. The Kings County Supreme Court orders directed that the funds be deposited within 5 days. There were no deposits within 5 days. In fact, there were no deposits, as I said, for 10 years before the charged crime on Forbell, and 6 years on the charged crime in 8th Avenue. If we turn to the law and to respond further to the question of why there's no jury issue in 2008, U.S. v. Irvine, which I realize, Your Honor, is not a New York case, but is a Supreme Court case, I hope the court will indulge me in listening to a brief description of it. The attorney defendant there was charged with withholding funds from a client for 5 years after payment had been demanded. The Supreme Court said the crime was committed when there was a duty of immediate payment and, quote, a refusal to pay on demand without just excuse, close quote. The statute of limitations was 2 years. The charges were not brought for 5 years. The Supreme Court dismissed the charges. We could hardly have a more authoritative demand in this case than we do. We have a New York State statute, and we have two court orders that set a very precise date certain as to when payment was supposed to be made. But there was a refusal to pay. And in fact, that
court order in the statute created a legal duty on your client's part to remit the funds, but I'm not sure that constitutes a demand.
In our view, a statute and a court order telling an individual to make a payment within a certain period of time has to have as much authority as a private party who is a principal telling an agent, I'd like you to make a payment as of a certain date. We don't
demand a demand that is outside the ordinary course. I mean, you have described that, and the government has described Mr. Sampson as managing many different referee accounts. According to this process, you know, the funds get deposited, they're supposed to be returned at a certain time. But as Judge Livingston says, that I see that as in the nature of a legal duty whose, you know, if one overlooks it by a few days or 10 days, that's different from declining to produce in response to an out-of-the-ordinary request for payment. Someone calls and says, hey, you haven't paid, and he says, I'm not going to. That's something else rather than a failure to remit timely. I mean, if evidence is, in my view, a level of consciousness of a failure to comply with the duty.
Well, there's nothing to suggest that Mr. Sampson, who, as Mr. Solomon said, handled these matters often, was unaware of the statute or the court orders. And again, we would submit that directives that issue from a statute and from courts have to have as much effect as a directive that issues from a private party who asks her agent to do something. In Irvine, the Supreme Court said, you know, it would be unreasonable to prosecute this kind of case 20 years after the fact. Obviously, we're not talking about 20 years here, but as to Forbell, the government is trying to prosecute 15 years after the statute and court orders required payment. As to 8th Avenue, the government's trying to prosecute 11 years after the fact. I think it's critical to note that in Irvine, there is absolutely no discussion of withdrawals by the defendant or any other activity with funds by the defendant. That simply is not an issue. The issue is that he was directed to provide funds. He refused to do so. He continued to refuse to do so. But the court found that when he failed to respond to the demand, that's when the crime was committed.
What do you make of the government's view that the Irvine case, in effect, has fallen into desuetude? To quote the government's brief, it belongs to an ancient line of cases, etc., requiring as an element of the crime of a fiduciary's misappropriating funds from a fiduciary account that the victim of the alleged crime must have demanded payment from the judiciary.
Well, I'm probably guilty of doing this myself, but I do think it's an old lawyer's trick that if there is a case that was issued many decades ago and you don't have a particularly good basis for distinguishing it, you just say, wow, that's really old. The fact that it's ancient and still on the books, if anything, underscores its viability. And again, we would address the issue of the demand by saying it's not as if Sampson had no obligation to remit these funds to the court. It's very clear that he was obligated to do that, both by the court orders and the statute. So to say, as the government does, that there's no demand in this case, I really think removes any meaning from the word demand.
Am I right in understanding, though, that between 2002 and 2006, the records show that Mr. Sampson made periodic withdrawals from both the 8th Avenue and the Four Bell Street accounts?
We are missing records, which is a point I'd like to address in a moment, but what the records we have show is that by 2006, $27,500 had been withdrawn from the 8th Avenue account. The records show that by the time we get to the charged crime in 2008, approximately $65,000 had been withdrawn from that account, the lion's share of which was withdrawn in 2007.
8th Avenue in both.
I'm sorry, no. $27,500 on 8th Avenue. And then as to Four Bell, by the time we get to the charged crime in 2008, something in the neighborhood of $65,000 had been withdrawn, most of which was withdrawn in 2007.
So if, for example, we were not convinced that on day six the crime was complete, his withdrawals for personal use during this time period before 2006?
Eight.
Before 2008, also reflect his use of the funds for his personal needs.
Not only that, Your Honor, but if day six doesn't seem like an appropriate date, we also have to remember that by week six and month six, and in the case of Four Bell, year six, there had been no deposit with the court. Now, the government is very careful never to say that as a matter of law, there is no embezzlement on the sixth day, or in the sixth week, or in the sixth month, or in the sixth year. And we can all be fairly well assured that in a different case, if we got to the sixth week, or sixth month, or sixth year, the government would argue that an embezzlement had occurred based solely on withholding and without respect to withdrawals. And so it is careful to try to preserve that the flexibility to argue that in a subsequent case. But you can't have it both ways. If the crime, if there's no defect as a matter of law in charging someone in the sixth month, then you can't say that the statute of limitations has not begun to run. And if we think about statute of limitations issues more broadly, to come back to a point that was raised earlier, one of the main purposes of a statute of limitations in a criminal case is to protect a defendant from claims based on stale evidence. Here, the government's theory is that no matter how long you hold this money, it's only embezzled if you withdraw the funds. But we don't have banking records for Four Bell from 1998 till 2003. We don't have banking records for 8th Avenue from 2002 to 2004. What if all the funds were withdrawn in those years and then put back? Even under the government's theory, that would mean the embezzlements occurred well before 2008, but we simply don't have those records. Another implication of the government's argument that there's no embezzlement absent a withdrawal is that a referee could just hold funds indefinitely for years without withdrawing them, without using them, and not commit a crime. If the referee died decades later and somebody else used those funds without knowing the source, presumably, under the government's theory, there never would have been any crime at all. Now, again, we know that the government wouldn't really take that position in another case.
Isn't the government trying to prevent against premature prosecution where negligence or someone's hospitalized, or, I mean, that this isn't the case here, you know, the mere failure in part of a routine bureaucratic transaction to remit doesn't establish necessarily a prosecutable crime. They're looking for something that where there's been a clear reflection of an intent to exercise, to take the money for oneself, to convert and use the money, and that's what each of those withdrawals reflects. Why isn't that a legitimate approach?
Well, I won't comment on what the government's true motive here is, Your Honor, but to address that point, in Irvine, the court said, look, if you have some excuse, then potentially the crime hasn't been committed, but otherwise, when you fail to respond to the demand, the crime has been committed. In this case, this is plainly not a negligence case because funds were not remitted for the life of the period before the alleged crimes occurred. And again, ultimately, what the government never says is that it is not a crime as a matter of law if you fail to remit funds within these periods. Now, obviously, if the government prosecuted somebody on the sixth day or the sixth week or six months, the defendant might well argue inadvertence or negligence.
Well, but that's back to Judge Livingston's question. Why isn't that for the jury to decide then?
Because here we have a series of admissions. We have undisputed facts that these funds were not withheld for some short period of time after the demand, but rather for years, that during those years, funds were withdrawn. And we have Irvine and Toosey, which, as Supreme Court cases, stand for the proposition, first, that if you don't respond to that demand for payment and you can't come up with any excuse, you have committed the crime. And second, if a five-day period in which you're supposed to act expires and you have not acted, you have committed the crime. So given all of that,
about the government's admissions, looking back at my notes, according to the government, it made representations at trial and in post-trial papers that your client had embezzled funds in the late 90s and early 2000s, if I'm reading this correctly, but it never represented that all the money had been embezzled by 2006.
That is utterly false. There are two briefs submitted by the government to the district court in which it explicitly stated that the embezzlements were completed by July 2006. That's in the special appendix at page 27 at page 29. Moreover, it said to the jury that in the late 1990s and early 2000s, hundreds of thousands of dollars were embezzled. Well, that necessarily means all the money that was in those accounts. And the charging instrument, when it says there were embezzlements in 1998 and 2002, when there were no withdrawals at all, necessarily alleges that the embezzlement was based on the failure to pay. The failure to pay relates to all the funds. No subset of funds was treated differently from any other. Therefore, all the funds were embezzled at those times.
Tell us about Special Appendix 27 and 29. What is it that we're supposed to find there?
Supplemental appendix.
Supplemental appendix.
Forgive me.
On
page 27 of the supplemental appendix, bottom of the page, the very last sentence, it says, quote, instead, between approximately 1998 and July 2006, the defendant embezzled approximately $440,000 from escrow accounts, et cetera, close quote. That $440,000 is the total that the government says was embezzled not only from these accounts, but from two other accounts that it cited evidence of for various purposes.
On page 29?
And on page 29, if we look at the second full paragraph on that page, and in that paragraph, the penultimate sentence, again, it says, quote, instead, between about 1998 and July 2006, the $440,000 was embezzled. And
the conclusion you draw from those two sentences is what?
That consistent with the arguments made at trial to the jury, consistent with the charging instrument, the government is saying that the funds were embezzled not simply due to withdrawals, but because of the failure to pay. And obviously, when they're putting an end date of 2006, there hadn't actually been any withdrawal at all from the Forbel account. So that statement about embezzlements ending in 2006 is utterly inconsistent with the idea that, oh, you can only have an embezzlement if there's a withdrawal.
Now, as to the question of the government's true motivation, as you called it, and as to which you expressed agnosticism or that took the Fifth Amendment, what should we make of that? Do you have anything to say on that question?
I think that the government is being very careful to preserve its ability in another case to argue that if somebody wrongfully withholds funds for 6 years but doesn't withdraw them, embezzlement can be charged. And also say in this case, well, you need a withdrawal, and so holding the funds for 6 years, that doesn't really matter in terms of the embezzlement, which is the position it's taking now, contrary to all of the admissions. Those two positions can't exist simultaneously as a legal matter.
All right, so we've given you a good deal of extra time. Now we'll hear from Mr. Solomon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Was going to set everything straight.
Hopefully, Your Honor. Super quickly, three points. The first point, speaking to our motives here are not to protect some unspecified case. Our motives here are to protect the jury as fact finder with respect to the issue of intent. Secondly, with respect to the issue of the two Supreme Court cases relied on by my colleague, Irvine and Toosey, Irvine is inapplicable. It is old. That's not our main argument. Our main argument is it doesn't apply here because we're talking about a different statute with different elements. There is no demand element in the embezzlement statute at issue here. Secondly, Toosey is inapplicable because, yes, it's a Supreme Court case, but it's dealing with enrollment for the draft, which is a strict liability crime. That is not the case here. The third point I'll be a little bit longer on, and that's our alleged misrepresentations or prior inconsistent representations to the court. I think it's useful to, if you can indulge me for 30 seconds with respect to some background. After Judge Irizarry dismissed our two embezzlement counts, we successfully moved to introduce evidence at trial of the embezzlements to show the defendant's motive to commit the alleged obstruction of case. So the evidence showed that as of July 2006, Sampson had embezzled a certain amount of money. I think it was approximately $440,000. He approaches Ed Ahmad, says, I have a problem. I've embezzled this money. I need to replenish the funds, asks for a check. Ahmad gives him a check. The reason why our filings, our Rule 29, Rule 33 filings, deal with July 2006 is because that's the date when he has the conversation with Ed Ahmad and receives the $188,500 check from Ed Ahmad. So there was no, it simply was not the case that we were arguing to the jury or arguing to the court that all of the embezzlement had been complete as of July 2006. There was a very precise reason why we mentioned July 2006 in our briefs to the court.
So what numbers, how do you add up to the $440,000? What are you attributing to 4 Bell Street and 8th Avenue as of that time period?
I don't have the math in front of me, Your Honor, but there were four separate accounts that we introduced at trial. There were these two accounts. There were two other accounts from which he had embezzled funds. If you look at all those funds together as of July 2006.
That's not my question. My question is what numbers were you relying on as to 4 Bell and 8th Avenue? But I guess you don't know.
Mr. Solomon,
yes.
You should feel free to consult with your colleague.
Sure.
We operate like the inns of court. We, you know, the juniors and seniors can talk for a while. Go talk to them. The purpose of oral argument is not to entrap counsel. Go on.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the indulgence. So my colleague informs me, and this is consistent with my memory, that the $440,000 did not include the amounts that were still remaining in the Four Bell and Eighth Avenue accounts as of July 2006.
It was only the balances that
he had taken out.
He had taken out.
Yes. And finally, the defense relies on the case GAF, which stands, to stand for the proposition to the extent there are prior representations made by the government that are inconsistent with its current stance, that the appropriate remedy is dismissal of the relevant charges. That's not what GAF stands for. GAF stands for, to the extent there are prior representations that are inconsistent, those representations must be presented to the jury. So if this court were to find that we made representations which were inconsistent with our representations to this court, and we disagree with that, we would disagree with such a finding, then the appropriate remedy is to remand and present our alleged prior misrepresentations to the jury.
Yes, I've given you extra time, but why don't you conclude by telling us what exactly you want from us? What is your preferred decree of this court?
We're seeking reinstatement of the two embezzlement counts.
With what result? That is, what happens after you achieve that victory?
So that the defendant can be tried on these two counts, and that the jury can determine whether he had intent to embezzle the funds as alleged in 2008.
And that would require a trial on these counts, which would be an additional new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Wait, could I ask just one thing?
Sure.
So the jury then would also be in a position to determine whether the crime was complete before the statute ran?
Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We reserve decision on this.
My apologies, just because it's a factual issue that was just raised.
Go ahead. Take 30 seconds.
Looking at page 37 of the government appendix, which is one of the many charging instruments, but this allegation remains the same in all.
Are we in the supplemental appendix again?
No, the government's appendix.
Government's appendix.
Yeah. At page 37, paragraph 5.
Yes. Which begins, since approximately 1998.
The defendant, John Sampson, embezzled approximately $440,000 in funds from escrow accounts relating to foreclosure proceedings involving four Brooklyn real estate properties. This underscores that $440,000 is the total amount the government claims Sampson embezzled on all properties, including the two at issue here, and directly contradicts the idea that the government subtracted out from its submissions to the district court.
What about paragraph 6? Irrelevant to all
it
of
doesn't bear. It doesn't bear on the issue of what the $440,000 refers to and whether it includes all amounts in the Four Bell and Eighth Avenue account.
Okay. Thank you very much.